There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Malcolm Taylor. Now, coming up, you can get a tourist visa to Saudi Arabia. We're going to get more details about the kingdom's new plans to attract holidaymakers. Plus, the recruitment company Mums at Work is rebranding as Women at Work today. We're going to find out why. And as World Investor Week kicks off, Peter Smith of the regulator DFSA tells us how to invest wisely, or at least how to avoid getting scammed. But first we look at corporate governance. We've had a plethora of cases lately where companies and their employees have suffered because of poor behaviour by management, leading to hastily made decisions with unfortunate consequences. WeWork, Boeing, Thomas Cook, Uber, several others have hit the headlines for the wrong reasons in the last few weeks and months. And in the studio is a man who's been preaching long time for better corporate governance, as long as he's been a friend of the Business Breakfast, in fact, which is just about forever. Good morning to Dr. Nasser Saidi, president of Nasser Saidi and Associates. Lovely to have you back in the studio. WeWork last week is just the latest piece of corporate mismanagement that's reduced shareholder wealth. What's your view, Nasser, on why this keeps happening? You'd have thought that senior managers and company owners would be advised by advisors more now than ever before.
That's true, but I think you've got two aspects. One is there's this hype about technology. Yeah, I mean, all the companies that we're talking about, Uber, WeWork, others that have fallen either pre or post IPO, reflect this big hubris that we have about technology that is going to solve everything. What that has meant is that it has attracted a lot of money into the sector. So you look at venture capital, you look at private equity money, at a time when cash was plentiful and very low interest rates, got attracted into the tech sector. That meant that you could burn a lot of cash. You could burn a lot of cash on vision. Now, the problem, of course, is that vision is very nice, but you always have to look at the bottom line. And people were not looking at the bottom line. What it really requires, particularly pre-IPO, is that you get reporting on a continuous basis. You have to impose internal controls. You have to have good governance. You have to have somebody at the level of the board who holds back the visionary CEO. That's not easy to do because many of these people have personalities which are overpowering at the level of a board. They founded a company. Nobody wants to hold them back. And yet, that is the role of the board. And you need to have strong personalities at the level of the board to hold back that visionary founder and entrepreneur.
We've heard reports over the weekend of, given the sort of the woes in the corporate world in the States over the last few weeks, that investors now should be and will be focusing more on profit, bottom line, rather than these blue sky valuations.
On valuations, yeah. Absolutely. And again, if you look at the valuations, and several parties contributed to those valuations. You've got the investment banks that make a lot of profits by bringing high valuations onto the market. You've got the venture capitalists who put in money at the beginning who also want to earn a high return. And you've got the founders and entrepreneurs who also want to make a lot of money. Call it another name, greed. And you have to hold back greed. What that means is that the accounting profession, the audit committee at the level of the board has to be very careful about these valuations. If you look at the case of WeWork, right, it was earning $1 in revenue for $2 in
expenditure.
Well, somebody should be looking at the bottom line. And what's surprising in the case of WeWork is that then one of the two co-CEOs today was previously the CFO of the company. So you ask yourself, is this an improvement in governance to get a person who was CFO, who was therefore responsible for the accounts and reporting of the company, now co-responsible for the company itself.
Who might be the very guy who's avoiding the questions about the finances.
Correct.
I mean, the valuation of WeWork, $47 billion reduced to 20, then 10, and the IPO was scrapped in its entirety. The founder, Adam Neumann, stacked up a host of bad practices, really, to badly harm the company's image. Whose job should it have been advise him? I mean, was it the CFO's job or somebody else? Should we have a sort of governance officer?
Well, there were several issues. If you look at the corporate structure of WeWork, the best description of it is that Byzantine. It's very opaque in terms of structure. But more important, if you look at the people on the board and the people surrounding Adam Neumann, a lot of them were family related. Cousins, people related to his wife, etc. There is a bit of nepotism that always happens because the founder says, I can only work with people I can trust, and they give them free rein. What needs to happen is this is where you bring in independent non-executive directors. That is their role. Probably over time, what I've learned is that one of the most important aspects of having a NED is the ability
to say...
A non-executive director... is the ability to say no. Do you have a director at the board who is able to say no? That is very important. Do you get regular reporting? Do you question the valuations that are brought in, whether it's by the investment bankers, advisors, or by your own CFO? Those are the sorts of questions that need to be asked, hard questions that need to be asked at the level of the board.
We really appreciate your input. Thank you, Dr. Nasser Saidi, the president of Nasser Saidi and Associates. Lovely to have you back in the studio. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Evening, you're listening to The Business Breakfast. I'm Malcolm Taylor.
Scams and how to stop them. One of the themes that will be discussed at the World Investor Week, which starts tomorrow. Joining us in the studio to give us some insight and a local perspective is the Managing Director and Head of Strategy, Policy and Risk at the Dubai Financial Services Authority, Peter Smith.
Thank you.
I'd never heard of World Investor Week before, but apparently it's the third one. It's a global thing that aims to do a couple of things. One, educate investors about investing to make sure we do invest. And secondly, protect investors so that when they do, they don't get, to quote Jamira Kwai, scammed. What are you doing here in Dubai?
Well, a bit of background first. World Investor Week is an initiative of IOSCO, which is the International Organization of Securities Commissions, a body that brings together securities regulators around the world and set standards for how we should deal with those firms in those industries. So that's securities, funds, exchanges, and so on. And World Investor Week is their initiative. And as you said, it's the third one this year, running from 30th September to 6th October.
So what's the problem that they're trying to solve with this?
The problem is that there are many, many people out there who don't know how to invest their money. They don't know how to make sensible decisions when investing their money. And there are lots of less scrupulous people trying to deprive them of their money, which is the scams that you refer to.
Okay, so let's break those down into the first two things. Lots of people don't really know how to invest, so they just do nothing. And hands up, I think there are three guilty parties sitting in the Business Breakfast studio here who've all done that at some stage. Not that we've got loads of money, but the little that we do have, often we just kind of do nothing. How do you tackle that?
Well, I think investor education, which is the first part of the World Investor Week themes, along with investor protection. For investor education is all about trying to give the right information to investors, to the public, so that they can make more sensible decisions and particularly so that they can recognise when they're presented with something that is likely to be untruthful or is likely to be a scam. Investor education is difficult to do well because getting the right messages across to the right people is quite a challenge. But IOSCO, securities regulators around the world, other bodies in the UAE, a lot of people are trying to improve the level of investor education and improve the level of financial literacy so that customers, the man in the street and wealthier people, can engage in a more confident manner and make better decisions.
You mentioned financial literacy there. I was looking at some examples over the weekend of scams, and would you spot a scam or not? And they showed you letters from your bank and letters from the fake bank, and it's really hard to spot the difference, even if you know what you're looking for. And I kind of was 50-50 about whether I got them right or wrong. Financial literacy is one thing, but how do you actually spot a scam?
Well, I think the first maxim I would mention is an old one and a familiar one, which is that if it sounds too good to be true, it almost certainly is too good to be true.
But I think one of the things they showed for me was that in the UK, the interest rates might be 2.2% or something. They were offering 2.5%. It wasn't like, we're offering you 10%. You know, look, come to us. 2.2, 2.5%.
And there's no doubt that many of the scams that are out there are quite sophisticated. So what we recommend that people do is firstly look at it, do a bit of research with your regulator in the jurisdiction you're in, look on their website, is the firm itself actually regulated or not? If it's not, I would suggest staying away from it. If it is regulated, that should give you a degree of confidence. But even if it's not regulated, you can find lots more information about people nowadays. We all use the internet all the time, and you should do a bit of homework. Does what the firm is saying to you about the financial service or the product, does it stack up? Do your homework. You know, don't just say, this looks wonderful, I'm in. You need to do a bit of homework, and individuals all need to be prepared to do that.
So that's if you get approached by someone and you've got to check out what that is. But what if you don't get approached by anyone and you're just sitting on your hands doing nothing? And there'll be people driving to work who are maybe in that situation, who've worked hard, saved a bit of money, but don't quite know what to do with it. What are some quick and easy tips for getting invested, for making your money work for you?
Well, I mean, you mentioned financial literacy earlier, which is obviously the broader picture. Investor education is really a subset of that, because most people should really be starting, as you've said on the show before, I think, with some cash savings and things of that sort. But when it comes to investment, I think it is a matter of, for many people, start dealing with somebody that you know you can trust. Now, look at what the people have who you already deal with for some of your financial services. Do research to see whether other people offer something that's better.
But which brings us to almost the third issue. You've got really, really good investment advice, and you've got the scammers who are just trying to rip you off. But there's a bit in the middle, and we and others have spoken about this, where they are legitimate companies, but they're charging very, very high fees. It's not illegal, but it's not necessarily in the best interest of the person. We don't read the small print, and, you know, 15 years later, we find out that a lot of the money that we've earned has gone to XYZ financial services provider. How do we, if at all, guard against that?
Well, in most financial services markets, they say that, you know, the only certainty are fees and taxes. Obviously, in the UAE, the only certainty is perhaps fees, and you can never guarantee with an investment what the performance will be. A smart investor knows their investments will go down as well as up. A smart investor will invest for the long run to try and wash out those fluctuations in markets. But what it means is that the only thing you can be certain of is the level of charges, and so you should always prefer an investment with lower charges over an investment with higher charges.
Good luck with World Investor Week, Peter Smith of the Dubai Financial Services Authority. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi there, you're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Malcolm Taylor.
But where will Mariah Carey be? Richard Dina, at least, where has she been?
She has been in King Abdullah Economic City. Not this weekend, she was there earlier on this year. And it's all part of Saudi Arabia's move to open up to international norms and international customs. And another pillar of that move is the announcement this weekend, or not the announcement, but the implementation this weekend of e-visas. Georgia Tolley, our reporter, has got one. She's been in Saudi Arabia this weekend. I've got one as well. I logged on this morning, paid my 463 Saudi riyals, so I'm good to go.
I'm queuing up to get one.
Exactly. 10 minutes on a laptop.
I was going to say, how easy was it? What kind of stuff did they want to know?
It's really easy. There are only two technical things that were challenging, and they are not huge things. One is when you upload your passport for photo, it's got to be less than 100 KB. So like 1/10 of a meg, which is really, really small.
Literally a thumbnail.
No one's got photos small. So I had to shrink the photograph. And, and you've only got 9 minutes to do it. So the clock's ticking. You think, I've got to shrink this photograph to save. The other thing is, and again, it's really small. You know when you're like booking a hotel room and you click on the calendar and it's the year, the month and the date? When you can only scroll by month, not by year.
Oh, so it takes a while.
So for me to go back to my date of birth, 30th of March 1972, that's about 550 months ago. So I had to click literally 550 times to get back from...
Oh, you are joking.
No, we're
over. I'd have stand no chance, would I? I mean, really? What chance have I got?
Of doing that in 9 minutes.
But can you imagine?
That's just a little coding glitch, and I'm sure they'll fix that pretty soon. So those are the only documents that I needed to upload. Put in your passport number, and that's it.
Oh, look, there are big plans, as you've heard there in our headline. They want 30 million visitors by 2030. They want tourism to be 10% of GDP. I think it's running at about 2 or 3% at the moment with religious tourism. We're looking, obviously, at the business case for this. Tim Fox, chief economist at Emirates NBD, speaking to us about it. We asked him, from an economic point of view, how much of a game changer are these new tourism visas for the kingdom?
Not sure I would go as far as to say it's a game changer. While there is certainly a lot of potential in the tourism sector, there are a lot of issues that have to be tackled to make it successful. And tourism visas, I think, are only part of it, but obviously an important part.
Well, that potential is being jumped on by regional and international players. John Pagano is the chief executive of the Red Sea Development Company. It was set up in 2018, so last year, by the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. They're going to be developing a large section of coastline mounts. This is something that I know you've been looking at.
This is the Red Sea development. It's halfway between Neom up the north on the left-hand side, the west coast of Saudi Arabia, and then down to the Asir National Park, which is the lovely, beautiful area. Looks a bit like Yemen, rice paddies, etc., Yemeni architecture. It's kind of in the middle, just north of Jeddah there.
And a lot of Dubai companies will be interested in the $2.7 billion construction contracts that they want to award by the end of 2020. John Pagano has been speaking to Georgia Tolley about the project.
Our destination is absolutely pristine, untouched from any development. We have an archipelago of 90 islands that have not been touched, which is pretty remarkable, to say the least. It's also remarkable to a large number of Saudis who don't know this place exists within their own country. So it's that hidden, that untouched, that special.
Where is it?
It's about 550 kilometers north of Jeddah on the Red Sea, on the west coast of Saudi Arabia. We have a site of 28,000 square kilometers, which is, I used to say, we used to have actually more than that. When I used to say we were bigger than Belgium, now I say we're just a little bit smaller than Belgium. So we're talking about the size of a country that makes up the whole of the Red Sea destination. So we will have beautiful islands akin to the Maldives. It's the fourth largest barrier reef system in the world. But what makes it so different is that, unlike other systems in the world that are suffering from global warming, our corals are actually thriving. Against all odds, we have warmer sea temperatures on average, we have slightly higher levels of salinity, and for reasons that we still don't understand, our corals are thriving. In fact, we're working with our scientific partner, the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, to study what about our corals makes them so different and tolerant to some of the challenges that the rest of the systems in the world are facing, with the hope that maybe we can export what we learn here to help remediate coral reefs around the rest of the world.
And so there you go, a bit of tackling climate change, a bit of scientific discovery. But what about the tourists? John Pagano's been telling Georgia Tolley how they plan to open up for and attract them.
So we're creating a special economic zone, and the purpose behind that is to create a regulatory framework that is going to be attractive to both businesses and visitors alike. In respect to your specific question, it will allow relaxed social norms, which will allow Western attire and Western modes of behavior to be acceptable within the destination. So you will be able to experience the Red Sea as you do the Maldives and then some.
The Red Sea Development Company had a big presence at ATM all over the place. Lovely, sort of massive pictures of their sort of the quality of the sea, of their reefs, of their volcanoes. It's going to be interesting to see how they develop it.
Well, a lot of people there over the weekend having a look at what is happening with these new tourism visas, what it means for wider tourism in the Gulf. Will we see more people coming to one country, popping into another for a few days, popping to Oman maybe? Will it become more of a regional destination play? Here's a voice that you will recognise. Gerald Lawless, former president and group CEO of Jumeirah Group, is one who is in Riyadh at the moment. And our reporter Georgia Tolley caught up with him at the launch.
The Royal Travel and Tourism Council have today signed a major agreement with the SCTA, the Saudi Commission for Tourism and Heritage, here in Riyadh, to work together to help the kingdom in developing this really exciting phase of what it's doing with regards to really understanding the benefit of travel and tourism to society, to the economy. Economically, travel and tourism does account for 10% of global GDP, but very significantly it also accounts for 10% of global employment at almost 330 million people working directly and indirectly within the industry. And this is something that Saudi Arabia has really understood, and the benefits of travel, tourism and hospitality in relation to its own employment challenges to ensure that its national population have great opportunities within an industry that truly has come of age in terms of being highly desirable and an industry that gives great opportunities and great career progression for young people. And we have so many young people living in Saudi Arabia. It's great to be in an industry that can provide such a great opportunity for them.
Is there enough to see here?
Absolutely. I mean, they have UNESCO World Heritage Sites. They have just incredible coastline all up along the coast from Jeddah going all the way north. And, of course, within the mountains, the Al Ula, where they have the Nabataean city, which is very similar to Petra, the same civilization that obviously came over who wasn't a border at the time in terms of what they evolved and developed. And I believe there's massive pent-up international demand for visiting Saudi Arabia. Again, the World Travel and Tourism Council has done so much over the years to ensure that governments understood the benefit of tourism, understood that if you don't make it easy to buy, i.e. allow people to get visit visas, then you're not going to be able to evolve and develop your tourism industry. And Saudi Arabia gets that, and this is what they're doing now. So it's going to be a real, real game changer.
There's been quite a lot of headlines about the tourism minister saying that foreign women won't need to wear abayas. That feels like quite an important step for making women feel welcome in the country. What do you think?
I think women are respected always and welcomed in the country. Okay, you don't have to cover your head, you don't have to cover your face, and that's fine. That's an individual choice now, even for Saudi ladies, they don't have to do that. So, you know, from that perspective, when you come to a country, it's nice to sort of adopt some of the culture and traditions of the country in which you're visiting and get to understand it. And yes, it's nice you don't have to wear the abaya, but actually I think a lot of women like wearing it.
And so how quickly do you think Saudi Arabia might start to compete with Dubai?
Well, I don't know that it competes with Dubai. I mean, what I see very much is that His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, he's the man that had the vision, but more than just having the vision, he had actually the energy and the courage to execute that vision. And I see very much the same traits within His Highness Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud here, in that is a gentleman that's in a hurry, he wants to get things done, he understands and is impatient to make sure that everything is finished as quickly as possible, is developed as quickly as possible as far as tourism is concerned. But Dubai isn't suddenly going to go backwards. Dubai is already the fourth most visited city in the world. The airport is the third busiest airport in the world. So Dubai will continue to evolve. We'll look at its markets, and Saudi Arabia will certainly be a complementary market for Dubai as well. And I'm sure for many two-centre destination holidays, people will come to both destinations. And I'm sure as well the Saudis will continue to love coming to Dubai.
That's Gerald Lawless, former president and group CEO of Jumeirah and former chairman of the World Travel and Tourism Council, as he was referring to there, speaking to Georgia Tolley in Riyadh.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Evening, you're with The Business Breakfast. I'm Malcolm Taylor.
Recruitment company Mums at Work has helped thousands of women get back into the workforce after breaks for maternity and child rearing. Today, though, they are changing their name. They are no longer Mums at Work. Today, they are becoming Women at Work. We're going to find out why. We are joined now by Managing Director Louise Karim. Why are you rebranding?
We were always going to go down this route. We started very much focused on mothers because they're the people in society that need most flexibility. And we wanted to champion this untapped talent in the market. Now it's time to grow. Now it's time to expand our offering. We've had so many women come to us, kind of raise their hands and want to join our events, our training, apply for a job. And they're, but I'm not a mother. But it's okay. So basically what we're doing is supporting all women in the workplace. There's a real need for, as we know, for a better gender equality in the workplace, for more women being acknowledged for their skills and talent. And also women have different elements that they need supporting with within the workplace. So basically from now, we will support all women in the workplace in the UAE.
What does that actually mean, though, support on a practical level?
Okay, so as a business, obviously we have roles. We're a recruitment company. But what we do is we really champion that untapped talent from females with businesses. So we help them recognize who's out there, help them fulfill the goals for particularly mid to senior level females. It's a real issue here in the UAE and globally. So that's where the roles come in. But we also have a sort of a suite of vetted coaches and trainers that we've worked with throughout the region. And they undertake events, workshops, training for anything from CV writing to negotiation to sort of getting your step up the, you know, on the glass ceiling, getting onto the board table. So really throughout your career, we have advice and help either online through our online training portal or through our weekly events with our coaches.
I can imagine people waking up in the morning and say, I want to change my company name and thinking, nah, it's probably too hard. How difficult is it in reality?
Practically, it's not that difficult, but obviously we've worked very hard to build up our brand.
What do you have to physically do to change the name?
Not that much, really. You work with the authorities that need be, but it's we've actually not just changed our name, we've changed our offering more importantly. So we've our whole website is different. Our online training and videos and everything that we've got is more in depth than we had before. But to actually change your name, it's not that difficult.
So you didn't have to go through a new application process. You just changed the name on the documents that are already there.
Exactly, because we're actually partnered under Mackenzie Jones. Yeah. So that makes it quite simple for us to do that because that's our sort of parent company.
Are you worried about losing some of that recognition that you are known as Mums at Work?
Of course, yeah. My background is marketing and branding and PR before I started this. So yes, I do have that nervousness. But what I want to reiterate is that we're still there. We're still there to support mums. We're still there to champion flexible work and part-time work. But now we've expanded. So, you know, whatever stage in your career that you're at as a female, from a fresh grad through to someone taking a career break, through to someone trying to make that step up to senior management, we can be there to support you along the way.
Was there enough business for you in getting mums back into the workplace? Because what you've been doing has been very niche. You've been working with employers who are willing to be flexible, whether that flexibility is to do with hours, whether that flexibility is to take a bit more of a risk with someone who's been out of the workforce for a number of years, or who maybe has a slightly different skill set if they're trying to enter a new industry.
Yeah, there's definitely enough business and that business is growing day by day. People are recognising that talent that is out there that is being overlooked. So, for example, our returnship programme, we've worked with many multinationals very successfully on bringing women back into the workplace after a career break. A lot of multinationals have this programme in place globally and they're starting to sort of see that work here in the UAE. Commercially, did it work? Yes. We broke even in 18 months. We stood on our own 2 feet. So there's definitely the business out there, but there's also a lot of not only candidates, but also companies that want women in the workplace, particularly in that mid to senior level role. So that's really why we've opened up our doors to all women.
Where are we at the moment from what you see with the companies that you work with and the wider organisation that you're in, that you work with? in the UAE in terms of getting that gender balance right higher up the chain?
We've made progress in the last 3.5 years, for sure, but it is slow. I was reading some global stats from McKinsey that gender balance is stalled, that people, you know, are talking a good game, but not necessarily delivering the elements within a workplace to allow gender balance. Now, as I mentioned before, we've worked with a lot of multinationals here who have global policies, so that works pretty well. But it is, you know, it's not an easy task to get people to recognize why they should have women in these senior roles.
What is the difficulty prejudice or is it availability?
No, I think it's just ingrained culturally sometimes. So a lot of senior members of multinational companies completely get this. They agree with it. They know they should have, you know, a diverse workforce. Now, we're only talking about gender right now, but there's obviously lots of other elements that are within that. But culturally, is it trickles down the organization. Sometimes there's some blocks, I think, in having women in certain roles.
What do we need to do then? What will make a difference here?
I think recognition in the workplace for supporting different members of society. Okay, so we're looking at gender right now. So women, especially if they're mothers or going to be mothers, they want flexibility. Everyone wants flexibility, but, you know, mothers need it. How they support women throughout their career as well, because they have different, we're different to men. Everyone's different, but we're different to men in terms of things like negotiation, in terms of, you know, confidence, all these elements that women need more support on than men. So a perfect example is a man will apply for a new role if he has 60% of the job spec. A woman won't until she's got about 99%. So obviously I'm generalizing here, but there's elements that companies can do in terms of unconscious bias training, in terms of looking at the language that they use for job ads. Simple things like that actually do have an impact.
Good luck with your rebranding. Louise Karim, the Managing Director of what is now Women at Work. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. We're back tomorrow, 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.